It's a hand holding. It's a kiss on the cheek. And it's just very, very sweet.
It's not Jenny and Greg, right? It's not a teenage romance. It's all, yes, yeah. They're 13, no. But it's a preteen romance. It's first love. It's not teen love. So it's not leader of the pack. It's not Jenny and Greg and from All My Children. It's a step before that. So it retains his innocence.
Hello world, is a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. Whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the Big Wheel generation who saved their allowance for Bubble Yum, Bubblicious, and Big Daddy Bubblegum.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we'll be saving the quiet little movie that captured teenage hearts and gave millions of kids their first crush in the form of a newcomer named Diane Lane in the 1979 sleeper hit, A Little Romance.
I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle, and we are your pop culture preservationists.
As we get closer to the release date of my new book, The Scott Fenwick Diaries, on July 22nd, we're zeroing in on the phenomenon that lies at the heart of that book and is universal to pretty much all of us, and that is the oh-so-melodramatic tweenage crush. We all had them, and I'm guessing that crush did not play out in real life the way it did in your daydreams. And that's because being 12 or 13 is one of the most unique time periods of your entire life. To be 13 is to be singularly and uniquely delicate, because you start yearning for things that you have no idea how to get. Yeah. You have absolutely zero experience or familiarity with this thing that you yearn for. If you are listening right now, you are probably beyond the age of 13. But nobody gets to 57 without being 13 first. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. We may have forgotten about it, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. And that thing we start yearning for at 13 is served up to us on a silver platter in the 1979 film A Little Romance, which allows us to see our daydreams come true. It stars a 13-year-old Diane Lane in her film debut, 13-year-old Thelonious Bernard in his first of only two movie roles, and one of the final film appearances by 79-year-old film veteran Sir Laurence Olivier, who shepherds two young lovers from Paris to Venice in their quest to fulfill the legend of kissing beneath the Bridge of Sighs at sunset while the bells toll, which will ensure that they will be in love forever. Some of you listening right now got Husker Dude big time at the mention of A Little Romance, and some people have no memory of it at all because this quiet little movie severely dented the hearts of those who saw it, but you could only see it if it came to your town, and this was not a blockbuster. Instead, it has been called the biggest sleeper hit of 1979. Did you guys have any knowledge of A Little Romance when you were young?
I'm so sad that I didn't, because I would have been all over this movie. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. What you said, though, I think is really important about, even though we're all in our 50s and we can say, oh yeah, we all had that, but we might have forgotten it. This movie, it's so authentic. It portrays this type of romance so authentically that you do then remember how it felt. You get all those feelings again.
It triggers your memories that you may have suppressed. You're like, no, 13 wasn't so bad. I don't remember who my crush was. Okay, watch this movie and it'll all come back to you.
Because it's not campy or goofy or silly. It's authentic. Yeah, it's very like realistic and relatable.
And I have no, this is so interesting, I have no idea exactly how successful it was, because I tried and failed to find box office information about A Little Romance, and I found nothing. I found absolutely nothing, except for that fact that it cost $3 million to make. But what I do know is, over the last 45 years, if I have found myself in the presence of somebody who saw A Little Romance when they were young, that person always, 100% of the time, was madly in love with this movie.
Yeah. I can see why. I'm really bummed that it didn't cross my path.
So it must just be that either it didn't come to where you were, or it was there for such a short period of time that you missed it. And if nobody was talking about it, how would you ever know?
Well, listeners, we're going to say this again and again and again and again. Go watch it. It's on YouTube. Go watch it. It is sweet and darling, and it's probably best known for its three primary cast members. I don't know about you guys, but Diane Lane came on my radar in The Outsiders first.
Me too.
And then Rumblefish. Both of those were in the same year. But A Little Romance was her first screen role, although she'd been acting professionally on stage since the age of six. At age 12, she had a role in The Cherry Orchard with Meryl Streep.
Oh, my God.
Wow. Yeah. She is very proud of this movie. I watched several interviews with her when she was doing press for Capote, the feud, the Capote versus the Swans.
Right. She was in
that. Because she was nominated for like an Emmy, I think. But this movie comes up, and she's very – she still loves to talk about this movie. She – makes this movie.
100%.
She is enchanting. Yes. I couldn't look away. Laurence Olivier, who, as you said, Kristen, I mean, sir, I guess we should say Sir Laurence Olivier, he called her the new Grace Kelly after making this movie with her.
And she was a child. She was a child and he called
her 13.
That. It's crazy.
Yeah. There isn't a scene where she doesn't deliver authentically and make you fall in love with her. Do you guys think?
She was so grown up. She's clearly a child. She's not made to be sultry or sexy. She's 100% a 13-year-old, but she just has such an air of maturity about her.
So much.
That she commands the screen.
100%. This character is gifted. I mean, she's very, very bright. So I think she plays that really well, too, because that's probably where we get a little bit of this more mature adult aspect of her character. But she does them both seamlessly. I mean, she's 13, especially when she's hanging out with her friend from school. But yet she can seem really mature in some of her other conversations, like the books she's reading and stuff like that.
I think in real life and also the character she plays, she's very mature.
Very
sophisticated. That lends itself to that.
She's
just so engaging. She absolutely pulls you in to every scene that she's in. And I've loved Diane Lane for years. And also she's 60, turned 60 this year, and she's drop dead.
She's beautiful too.
And just so, she's so classy when you watch current interviews. Like like I said, all of these were from 2024.
Very articulate and she thinks deeply and very thoughtful.
Well, in the early 80s, she was in quite a few films. You might remember her in Six Pack with Kenny Rogers.
Oh, my God.
Or in the cult classic punk film, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains.
I don't know that one.
But I had to mention it because I know listeners will remember that movie. But like I said earlier, it was her roles in the back-to-back films, The Outsiders and Rumblefish in 1983, that really put her on the map, even though she'd had this enormous resume already. I mean, from 6 to age 13, she had a whole bunch of plays under her belt already.
Wow.
Fun facts. You know I love a good almost cast fun fact, right? She turned down Splash and Risky Business for the movie Streets of Fire in 1984. That was with Michael Paré, I believe how you say his last name, Rick Moranis, Amy Madigan, Willem Dafoe, and Bill Paxton, among others. I just couldn't see her in Splash. It's only Daryl Hannah. And I'm assuming it's for that role of Daryl Hannah.
Right.
Bad reviews of that movie, Streets of Fire, and The Cotton Club, remember that was a big movie, led her to take a break to live with her mother in Georgia, but she returned to acting in the late 80s, notably with her role in the TV miniseries Lonesome Dove, which we mentioned in our miniseries episode. Mm-hmm. Also, another fun fact, she came very close to being cast as Vivian Ward in Pretty Woman.
Oh,
could you see that?
Okay, listen, think about that.
I think I could see it.
No, I don't, because these roles are iconic. They've become iconic for Julia Roberts and for Daryl Hannah.
That's true.
Right? And both of those roles were their breakout roles. So it's like those roles were just meant for those people. It wasn't meant for Diane Lane. It was meant for Daryl Hannah. It was meant for Julia Roberts.
I did read that when Diane Lane was considered for that role in Pretty Woman, the script was a little different.
It was darker. I was about to say that. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. So the script was darker when she was. But She had costume fittings and everything before
that's how far it got.
The role fell to Julia Roberts. Yeah, wow. She had scheduling conflicts with another acting gig, so she couldn't do it. But yeah,
so she had the role. It wasn't even that she was being considered. She had it, and then it interrupted. And
I mean,
went
I don't know
else.
At what point do you do costume fittings? I don't know. I have a list of just, she has so many great and memorable roles. And this is just a short list of some that are more popular, but the movie Jack, A Walk on the Moon, The Perfect Storm, My Dog Skip. My favorite of her performances was in 2002's Unfaithful.
Oh,
that movie. My husband and I love that movie. It's so good. Man of Steel. She played Martha Kent and then went on in Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, Justice League. Did you guys know that she's the voice of Riley's mom in Inside Out?
No.
Pixar movie Inside Out and Inside Out 2. I know. And then, of course, last year's feud, Capote versus the Swans.
That was good, too.
Which she was nominated for that. I think it's, you know, suffice it to say, we love her. Mm-hmm. We love her, all caps. She is pure class and grace and elegance. And then Laurence Olivier was a highly acclaimed English actor. We know this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to give his bio, but you know, he's an actor, director, producer, best known obviously for his iconic performances of Shakespearean plays. Also recognized for his iconic roles in films like Wuthering Heights and Marathon Man. Basically, he, like you said earlier, Kristen, he was 79 when he did this movie. He would only go on to do, I think, two more appearances in movies because he died in 1989 when he was 82.
Oh, gosh. Wow. Because he was so good in this movie and so just charming. I mean, really, the definition of charming is is what he was.
The charming elderly gentleman is who he was. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, when you watch this movie and you see how instantly smitten Lauren, Diane Lane's character, is with him as like a grandpa figure, that's how I felt even at 56 watching it. I was like, oh, I love him.
I know.
I want to take him home with me.
Yeah, because he was sort of like a protector plus entertainer a little bit. And so, so Diane Lane as the 13-year-old, it's almost like she needs a grandpa and he's going to be the grandpa.
And then, of course, we have Thelonious Bernard, who, like Kristen, like you said, this was his first film. He was actually just discovered by the director when he was like playing soccer. I'm sorry, football.
Yeah.
Like in the square.
Because he's French.
He's French. Yeah. And he lived with the director for a month so he could learn English.
What?
And
he didn't even know English?
No, he didn't know English. Wow. You know, his English is very halting, but it's very good.
It is.
It's very understandable.
And he's adorable. Oh, my God.
He's so cute. His only other film was, I can't say it because I'm not French. It was a French film, let's just say, a couple of years later in 1981. And then he chose not to remain in the film industry, but to just keep going to school, keep working on his education. And he currently lives in France where he is a dentist. And all I picture is in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I just picture Hermie like, I really want to be a dentist, though. This is, you know, and he's like, tap, 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 tap. To think that he had never acted before and that he lived with the director for, and he kind of like gave him acting lessons on the fly, right? He did a great job because he was super competent. He's kind of scrappy. He's streetwise, let's just say. And so he brought that confidence to this character. I will say I kind of ran hot and cold with him just because sometimes he was super abrupt with Lauren and I didn't like his hot temper and his bursts of anger. And then he would get really jealous of Julian.
He's French.
I mean, ultimately, at the end of the movie, my feeling is, I love Daniel.
I know.
Or no, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say it like Danielle. That. Danielle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So let's just be clear that overwhelmingly, I have positive feelings for him.
Well, before we move on, I want to talk about one of the other actors in this movie because as soon as I laid eyes on this person, I thought, what is he from? You know how we get those moments like, what else have they been in? And so I'm talking about Arthur Hill, who played Diane Lane's stepfather, Richard. And I knew him. I mean, I got this just warm feeling when I saw him. And I was thinking, no, he's not James Broderick. He is not Buddy Lawrence's dad from Family, but that's the vibe I got. And so, of course, after the movie's over, I've got to look up what I know him from. And I got so Hooskerdude. I keep saying when I get Hooskerdude, this might be the most Hooskerdude I've ever gotten. But this was something that I would have never, ever, ever remembered. He actually starred in a show during the early 70s, and it was called Owen Marshall, Counselor at Law. And as soon as I saw this title, I was like, I know that show. I know it. I know that name. And it was a show on ABC. Also, Lee Majors was in it. And, Arthur Hill was he was a lawyer. Mm-hmm. But he had a 12-year-old daughter in this show. And she was a main character. And I remember my mom, I think, really loved this show. So it would be on, and I'd be like probably half listening or doing whatever. But whenever there was the young girl would come on, I would pay attention. Mm-hmm. And it was such this loving relationship. And I felt that fatherly, loving feeling when he was on the screen. I couldn't pinpoint why until I looked all of this up.
Isn't that weird? Brains are so funny.
It just was living in me somewhere. Yeah. And so then I just wanted to read a little bit more about that show. And here is rabbit hole. Let's go down the rabbit hole. Carolyn, because we have to right here, guys. I'm sorry. I got to do this with you. Because I looked up the show, and yes, Lee Majors was one of the stars. This is obviously pre $6 million man, all of that good stuff. You guys, the guest stars on this show, they put Love Boat to shame.
Really?
They put any Gen X, Battle of the Network stars, anything to shame. I'm not going to read them all, but I'm just going to read you a careful few, okay? We had everybody from John Davidson and Pat Boone to John Denver, Mickey Dolenz, Patty Duke, Farrah Fawcett. We had Sharon Gless. We had Lou Gossett Jr. We had Mark Hamill. We had Pat Harrington Jr. We had Randolph Mantooth.
Oh, my God.
And Donald Mantooth. I don't know if that's his brother or his dad. Tim Matheson, Darren McGavin, Donna Mills, Ricky Nelson, Susan Sarandon, Dick Sargent, what? Tom Selleck, William Shatner, Martin Sheen, O.J. Simpson, and the best of all, I've saved it for last. I can't even believe I'm going to say this. Ready?
Yes.
John Sebastian.
Rory Calhoun.
No! Oh my God, you're kidding. The real Rory Calhoun?
The real Rory Calhoun.
Oh my God.
I circled it and everything.
Which is a coincidence, by the way, people who have read Worldwide Crush.
Right.
He's the pop star in Worldwide Crush. But I thought I made it up in my head. But there was an actual... like super crush named Rory Calhoun in the 50s, who then became an aging like Love Boat star.
Yeah. And he was on Owen Marshall, Counselor at Law, as a guest star.
Okay. That is hilarious. This show that we only Carolyn knows about, and all of these people were on it.
All of these people were on it.
Wow.
And lastly, Arthur Hill was one more character that you might not have known you knew, but you knew. He went on to play Lansford Ingalls. This would be Charles's dad in several houses of Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah, I remember that. He was depressed because the mom had died. Oh. Yeah.
Yes, and he...
That's when they shoot Bunny.
Yeah,
it is?
Yes.
Oh, I probably didn't see it. I had to turn off the TV.
Well, that's what I was going to say. He's in several episodes, and perhaps one of the most traumatic, if not the most traumatic for Kristen, is the two-parter Journey in the Spring. So Arthur Hill has played some
He's that guy that you don't know you know.
Right.
But you know him. Well,
and would be remiss also to talk about this movie without just mentioning Sally Kellerman playing Lauren's mother, because she's so dramatic.
Yes.
Houston. It's just so Houston. But, you know, I mean, starting in, you know, she played Margaret, you know, Hollips Houlihan
in the movie
MASH. And then she was, I mean, a million screen credits. Yeah. I mean, she was Jodie Foster's mother in Foxes with Scott Baio in 1980.
And these are two really important roles.
She was in everything.
Roles. They're smaller roles in the, you know, they're not the stars of the show, but Sally Kellerman and Arthur Hill are Lauren / Diane Lane's parents.
She only died 3 years ago. She was in her 80s, which is a nice long life, but yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. This movie really had some heavyweights.
It really did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to Diane Lane. Did you guys know that on March 3rd, 1979, she was featured on the cover of Time magazine with the title Hollywood Whiz Kids on the front cover? It was prior to the movie being released, so A Little Romance had not been released yet, and the article was actually highlighting this new wave of exceptionally talented young actresses in Hollywood, so they chose Diane to represent that on the cover, but the article also includes information about Brooke Shields and Jodie Foster, and talks actually a little bit about Christy McNichol as Buddy Lawrence in Family.
And I think it's interesting that she gets the cover of Time. She doesn't get Tiger Beat, right? Like, that's just how elevated Diane Lane is. As a child, she gets the cover of Time. That says so much about who she was, even as a 13-year-old, and even as people are falling in love with her. Like, people, so if you go online and look up A Little Romance, it'll be all people saying how they fell in love with Diane Lane at 13 years old. That was their first crush. Not Tiger Beat, Time Magazine. That just makes so much sense.
Yeah. And I think going to what we said earlier, how she just portrays this maturity that, you know, she's 13-ish on this cover, but she also doesn't appear to be 13. I mean, she was the right female actor to put on the cover, I think, to actually get people to pick up Time Magazine and say, who is this and what is this? She wasn't like a household name or anything.
Not yet.
Prior to this, to this article coming out. So
I kind of hate, though, when you go back and look at her early pictures when she was 13, and you can just Google Diane Lane and image search. There's so many. And I mean, it's same with Brooke Shields and people. So highly sexualized, all the pictures of her at age 13.
They don't know how to take pictures of women without making it sexualized. They just didn't.
Right. And I, what was interesting in this article, I thought the writer did a really good job of kind of trying to explain how these actresses now are playing sometimes these roles, like you're saying, the, you know, pretty baby and all that. Yes, they were sexualized, and we can look back on that now. He didn't come at it, you know, from that angle.
Well, that these movies were, I mean, they were highly acclaimed movies. They weren't trashy movies.
Well,
is that
right.
What
and these actresses, well, yes. And I think that these young actresses really portrayed these pretty deep roles, as
they did.
Awful as they might look now, looking back, they were not just these little children in, you know, a Disney movie.
Right.
These young people could actually
do big things,
pull it off.
Yeah.
So. But it's just sad when you see the photos, though, and it's so contradict. It's such a contradiction of Lauren, of the character she plays.
In this movie.
Not and so different than Brooke Shields is, like Pretty Baby or Endless Love roles. Lauren. So wasn't like that.
No. In. Lauren has her little blazer and her knee-high socks and her kilt.
All right. Well, you guys, we've talked about some of the actors that were famous in this movie and what they'd gone on to do. But I want to tell you guys a little bit about the director, okay? Because he just wasn't some schlep off the streets. This was a big deal. So not only are we getting Laurence Olivier and are we getting Sally Kellerman, but George Roy Hill was our director for A Little Romance. Do you guys know he was born in Minneapolis?
No.
Yeah, he's born in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Went to Yale, eventually went into the film industry. His film career actually took off with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
I love that movie.
Isn't that?
I love that movie.
Yeah.
Wait, what? Same.
I did.
As a child, I loved that movie.
It's the two of those two men as buddies. I think we love a buddy movie, and those were good buddies.
Yeah, and they had some good chemistry.
But I was like,
I hate to just pick up on that. You know, you just pick up on the fact that these two guys get along. They're kind of goofy. And that chemistry was so apparent that George Roy Hill went on to direct them again in The Sting.
Oh, he did The Sting.
Yes. And he won Best Picture and Best Director for The Sting. So he's
Everybody knows that. What is the Scott
It's The Entertainer.
The Entertainer.
That's right. That's another piano one right there with Nadia's.
If you took piano in 1975.
Right. And he also directed Slaughterhouse-Five, The Great Waldo Pepper, and Slapshot. I remember Slapshot. That was the hockey movie with Paul Newman, right?
Yeah. Those are all Paul Newman movies.
Yes.
And they're all like on the list of movies you should watch if in your lifetime.
Yep.
Basically.
And these are all prior to A Little Romance. So again, this isn't some director that's trying to get his first film. I mean, A Little Romance is, this is a big named director.
Such a departure from those other movies.
It is different, isn't it?
Well, actually, George Roy Hill has said that all of his movies have some element of coming of age within them.
Oh,
like that's a theme that somehow weaves itself in, and he can connect that through all of the movies. So from Slapshot to Butch Cassidy to A Little Romance.
And this is the ultimate coming of age movie.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Well, we shall not be outdone with our director. We're going to take it one more notch, and you guys are going to find out who the incredible man was who wrote the screenplay for A Little Romance, which earned him an Academy Award nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay. This was the distinguished American screenwriter, Alan Burns, okay? I'm not sure there is any other television producer, and writer whose work significantly shaped the American landscape of television, particularly for us, then Alan Burns.
Oh,
okay.
God, that's,
I mean,
a
come
statement.
On, people. And wow. This goes from his very beginning of his career when he was a part of creating the iconic series, The Rocky and Bullwinkle Show, Dudley Do-Right, and George of the Jungle.
What?
Yes.
George.
Watch out for that tree.
Right. Then he went on to create the beloved Cap'n Crunch character for Quaker Oats.
What?
He created Cap'n Crunch.
The man who wrote the screenplay for A Little Romance created Cap'n Crunch.
That's right. Cap'n Crunch.
Have you ever in your whole life until right this moment stopped and thought someone had to create
Never.
That Cap'n?
No.
Uh-uh. Who created Cap'n?
Yes. He's always been. He just like came down from
right.
heaven.
And with Adam and Eve.
With Adam and
just
Eve.
Like Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
What came first?
He didn't just stay animating characters. He went on then to create the Munsters and My Mother the Car, which I had totally forgotten about.
My there parents was a show loved called, that show.
Yes, my mm-hmm. mom loved that show. Mm-hmm. When I look at the chronological timeline of his career, it's really interesting that it really follows kind of our chronological growing up, because he goes on then to do some more adult-like shows. So he collaborates with James Brooks and joins the writing staff of Room 222. I loved that show.
I mean,
my mom
that.
Watched mm-hmm. it. I can't remember all of the storylines, but I loved it. I loved the outfits they wore, and it was so like hip and cool. But you guys, it didn't stop there, because Alan Burns and James Brooks partnered for what might be the most iconic Gen X show, at least for, in some ways, the three of us. And that would be the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
And now I see his name on the screen.
Well, now
I was thinking
that
same thing, too.
In that font. Yes.
In that font.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, of course, that show earned him Emmy Awards, including Outstanding Comedy Series. And this is all prior to A Little Romance.
Hi, listeners. Are you a small business owner, an author, an artist, or have something worthy to promote? If so, we have an exciting new opportunity for you. The chance to promote your product on the podcast and in our social media. Just like PBS, our episodes will soon be sponsored by you, with fun ads, read by us, placed in our extensive catalog of episodes and on our engaging social media platforms for a period of time determined by the package you select. For more information about the three types of ad campaigns available, contact us at hello@poppreservationists.com or look for a link in the show notes of this episode. This is a great opportunity to reach a lot of ears and eyes of fellow Gen Xers, and an easy way to have us help you keep on trucking. Okay, so here's a question. If those, like especially the director and the writer, I mean, have these just amazing bodies of work behind them, why wasn't this released more widely? Or
that's
why
a
wasn't
really good
the
question.
The PR, mm-hmm. you know, amped up for something like this? I'm shocked.
I am shocked too. I don't recall really any PR. I don't recall any promo. If we had seen the trailer for this movie, we would have been there in a hot second.
And if I wouldn't have been there in 1979, although I would have because I was 10, mm-hmm. but even so, this would have been like required viewing at every slumber party
yes.
I was at in 1981.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because
mm-hmm.
it would have been like on VHS by then or something.
So before we start talking about the storyline itself, let's talk quickly about the music. Did you guys notice the score? Did it add to your experience? And most importantly, I want to ask, did it remind you of anything? Because the music in this movie is important, and we'll talk about why in a second.
Well, I can say I think it definitely drove the movie for me. It was part of the feelings I got, you know, mm-hmm. when certain music was playing, whether it was fast or slow or whatever, it really added to the scene. It reminded me of something, but I don't know what. I mean, mm-hmm. I just was in Italy, so it felt like that could have been playing as I was walking the streets of Florence or something.
I'm going to tell you in a second what it reminded you of, and you're going to go, oh my God.
Yeah, I bet I will. Mm-hmm.
George de la Rue is the composer, and he won an Oscar for the score for A Little Romance. And the reason that it sounds familiar to you, Carolyn, is because it might be reminding you of Kramer versus Kramer.
Well, I have Kramer versus Kramer written down later in my notes.
And she acted with Meryl Streep.
Yes, she did. Complete the circle.
Is so crazy that you say that because a little later in my notes, I have the vibe that this movie gave me was a Kramer versus Kramer vibe.
Yes.
And like, would those movies still be made today? Because they're just so good. And, you know, it's just, but they're not.
And quiet.
Quiet. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like unassuming almost.
Unassuming.
These are the type of movies that creep up on you and then just grab hold.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the reason it reminds you of Kramer versus Kramer is because the composer wove the work of Vivaldi into his own compositions.
I love Vivaldi.
Yes. And we as children in particular came to know Vivaldi because it was incorporated into the Kramer versus Kramer soundtrack. All of a sudden, everyone knew the word Vivaldi. Nobody knew, our parents may have known it, but we kids didn't know Vivaldi until Kramer versus Kramer. So this is why the score sounds both, sounds vaguely familiar. So the love theme in particular in the movie is a melding of his own composition along with Vivaldi's Concerto for Lute and Violins in D major. He's bringing two things together. And so it's both familiar and perfectly matched to these two little lovers, to their love story. It's like adult music with sort of a childlike vibe to it. And it's also, this is classical music, right? So it's elevating the crushing experience, the teenage crushing experience of seventh grade, which, you know, let's be honest, that tends to get trivialized by adults or dismissed by adults as not real or not important. But when you set the seventh grader's love theme to Vivaldi, you are taking it seriously. You are saying that those feelings are important, but it's still all very innocent. It's not sultry or dramatic. It's tender. And it brought me to tears numerous times, especially, I'm sure we'll talk about this in a minute, at the end, the very final scene. Well, I'm not going to say anything now.
Don't say it yet.
But the music, combined with that end scene, I was sobbing. I was just sobbing. So like I said, it won the Academy Award for Best Score, and the other nominees that year included The Amityville Horror, The Champ, which had music by Dave Grusin, so that's super legit, Star Trek, and 10 with Bo Derek. And all of that music was composed by...
Oh, I remember that music.
That was big, right? That was huge. And that was composed by Henry Mancini. So he wins against these heavy hitters. It's quite amazing. Okay, so let's get to our story.
Let's do. And you might think I copied this synopsis from Wikipedia, but nope, I didn't. This is straight from my memory.
Oh,
and
nicely
you are
done.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, the movie follows the burgeoning romance between Lauren, Diane Lane, an affluent 13-year-old American with an IQ score of 167. FYI, 140 and above is considered genius or near genius. I did not know that with my own IQ score. I had to look that up.
Oh.
She's living in Paris with her mother and stepfather, and we love him, by the way. Carolyn told us all about him, and right away, we love him. And right away, wouldn't you guys say, just movies have taught us this? You're skeptical. You're like, he's going to be mean.
I know.
You're skeptical, and you're so happy when you're like, oh, he's so nice and loving. We love
Richard.
And
maybe that was weird. I was never once skeptical about him. Because I think because I had that, in my bones.
You already knew the counselor at law.
Right.
The first scene where he's, sitting there with his paper and his whiskey, I'm like, oh, he's going to be mean. Mm-hmm. And she comes right in and, kisses him on the cheek.
Yeah.
So she's living with mother, who's Sally Kellerman, and stepfather. And then there's Daniel, a classic movie-loving Robert Redford super fan, French boy, and now we know why those movies were thrown in there.
Oh my God, I didn't even put that together. Mm-hmm. And he's watching in the very first movie of opening of the movie, he's watching Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yep, he is, yeah. Yep, he loves classic movies, but he really loves Robert Redford, and that'll come back at the end.
Mm-hmm.
He's also 13, who lives with his kind of conniving and grumpy taxi driver father. Also, Daniel is also a genius. What are the odds?
What are the odds?
Well, funny you should ask that, because Daniel bets on the horses. On paper, I mean, he's only 13.
That's like his hobby.
Only, and he wins like 43% of the time. Lauren and Danielle's meet cute happens at a very chateau-y, museum-y type place where a movie is being shot. And there's actually, it's actually a very famous place. I can't pronounce the name, so let's just go with chateau-y, museum-y.
Wasn't it Chateau Levaux? Which I only know because there's...
I'm not French, so I don't know.
There's a Chateau Levaux Hotel on the North Shore of Minnesota.
Okay, so yeah, let's go with that.
You go there for pizza.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Daniel's class is on a field trip there, and Lauren is there with her mother, who is in the throes of flirting with the movie's director. But really, she's throwing herself at him. Do you see what I did there? Throws and throwing, just in case anyone out there missed that.
That would be me. I missed it.
Thanks,
Amelia. You with your wordplay? Come on.
I know. Sorry, I missed it.
Lauren and Danielle hit it. Well, it wasn't that good. Hit it off immediately and quickly start planning ways to go on dates. Now, after Daniel kicks a soccer ball, I mean a football, into an elderly man at the park, literally just floors him. He just goes whomp. And that's Sir Lawrence Olivier, by the way, and he plays Julian. They all go for hot chocolate, naturally, as you do after you injure an old
in
man
a beautiful Paris establishment.
With the coolest little glass pitchers of hot chocolate.
I wanted that chocolate.
I'm going to do that.
Yes.
I made a note as I was watching, like mental note. Winter, I'm getting little glass pitchers to pour my hot chocolate in first so then I can pour it into my cup. And Julian, Sir Lawrence Olivier, tells them the love story of him and his dead wife. And Lauren is particularly smitten when he tells her of this tradition. If a couple kisses in a gondola beneath the Bridge of Sighs in Venice at sunset while the church bells toll, they will be in love forever.
And she's like, let's do it.
I'm pausing for everyone to go, ah.
Yes.
Okay, now we're going to speed up. We're going to fast forward through this a little bit. After Danielle punches the movie director in the stomach for insulting Lauren at her birthday party.
That was adorable. That was so adorable. Because he's being that gross 70s dude, like the Ice Castles thing where you're
Did you get any?
Yeah, she's saying to the little 13-year-old boy, about the 13-year-old girl, did you get any?
Yeah, like did you score when you were up in her room?
In front of the girl's mother. It was, and Sally Kellerman's like, ha, 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 ha.
Oh, yeah. She's just like, whatever. And then he just hauls off and punches him in the stomach.
The 13-year-old little boy punches him in the stomach. Mm-hmm. It was awesome.
But, and this tells you a lot about the mother's character, because she then forbids the two from seeing each other again. And Lauren knows there's only one way out of her despair, to run away with Danielle to Venice. Well, now what follows is a delightful series of adventures and misinformation as Lauren's parents think Julian kidnapped them, and they do the whole Benji or Annie scene with the FBI is being called in, and there's a lot of important men on telephones in different rooms house. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And oh my gosh, there's a madcap bicycle race where Danielle, Lauren, and yes, even old man Julian hop on bikes and pretend to be contestants. I love that they all had the little hats on.
Yes, the little cloth hats, not helmets. Remember, we don't have bike helmets. We have the little Italian biking hats, because that'll protect you.
Right, and Lauren's trying to ride in her jean wraparound skirt.
Right.
We've got some clueless American tourists who save the day and then they don't.
Oh, God, they were so
funny. We have a lot of running. We have some Keystone Cops blunders. We have more running. We have so much running. A
lot of running.
And spoiler alert, we have a gondola ride in Venice.
Oh, God, and I just got goosebumps.
We have more than a little romance.
Oh, God. They actually, these kids make it happen. They take it upon themselves and they make it happen. And we have to emphasize the setting for all of this are the cobblestone streets of either Paris or Verona or Venice. Like the whole setting for every one of these scenes, even though it's the Keystone Cops, there's this European vibe throughout. And, and when the Keystone Cops are running, they'd be like, allons-y, allons-y, right?
And also, I think this is where the score that we talked about earlier really plays a significant role, because that music is playing and it doesn't sound Keystone Copy, but at the same time, you're getting that sense of urgency, or are they getting away, or the bike ride, and oh no, we've got to wait for, you know, Julian. And anyway, the music helps propel and tell that story, but not in a goofy, slapstick kind of way.
It
elevates it. It elevates it.
Exactly. Yes. And I can tell you why, because as I'm watching this movie, in the exact scenes that you're talking about, I was able to identify the style of music that they're playing as Baroque. Why? Because the class that I took in high school where I got a D in humanities, I learned about Baroque music. I learned to identify Baroque music in humanities, but I didn't do the work and I got a D.
Was that your senior year?
It was my senior year.
Yes. Yeah.
But I can still identify Baroque music.
I think that what you guys are both saying is spot on, because I said way at the beginning, this did not feel, this whole movie as a whole did not feel campy to me at all.
No.
So even though in my synopsis, in my recap, I was saying, you know, a series of adventures and misinformation, and there's this and this and this, and, you know, Keystone Cops, I made sure and say it's a delightful series of that.
Yes.
None of that felt, the drinking game, everyone, for as many times as Michelle's going to say authentic in this episode, but it didn't feel campy. It didn't feel silly. I was laughing at Kyle, like, of course were just here and cute. Now the cops are there.
It's not Benny Hill. It's not Benny Hill.
We just missed them. Yeah, it all worked.
Yeah.
Let's just say it all worked. And I think you guys, what you said is exactly right, because the score helped that.
That's right. It elevated the entire experience. And when you talked about their meet cute, and when they start to make a plan, like they meet each other and they're going to make a plan to see each other, that moment to me, I almost cried when they actually succeeded in making a date, because it's the most analog experience ever. They don't have phones. They don't know where each other lives. They have no email. They have no way to contact each other, which means they have to make a plan on the spot, in person, and commit to it. And it's very urgent. It's very urgent. They're like, where should we go? The Argent Triomphe. What time? At 3 p.m. Where do you live? And they're both smiling. There's this urgency because I have to go. I have to get on the bus. It's a field trip and I have to go.
Yeah.
But we're going to meet at this place. And there's this urgency. Will they show up? And then the scene ends and you can tell that both of their hearts are just swelling. But the tension of, are they going to show up at the Arc de Triomphe at the right time? How are they going to make this happen?
And you don't know. And one thing we haven't mentioned that maybe we pause to talk about here, because as the dates start to unfold, they rely on their friends, their best friends. And holy cow, I love these two characters
so
much. Funny. We don't even have time, I don't think, to do a whole deep dive on them. But the braces wearing, why did I just forget her name? Please remind
me of Natalie?
Natalie with the braces,
Who also went on to become a regular. That was pretty much A Little Romance was her only film that she ever did. So funny, so real, so real.
She's just going, God. With her braces,
oh God for everything.
I met a boy. God, I can't stand it. Who is he?
His name is Danielle.
He's French. God, what else?
He lives in La Grande, and his father drives a cab.
God, your mother will have a fit.
If she finds out, you better not tell her.
Are you in love?
You don't fall in love with the boy you just met.
Are you?
Yeah.
And then his best friend has like the fedora hat on, and he's like all of like 4 feet tall.
He's teeny.
Just the sight of those two slow dancing. His head is pressed up against her chest.
She's a head taller. She's like
what image? I'm getting an image, a very similar image from another movie.
16 Candles.
Oh,
It's Joan Cusack and Long Duck Dong. They're these two with the braces and they're dancing. And the writing for this best friend. First of all, you know, there are some complaints about this movie that the children are too sophisticated, but they're contrasted with these two best friends who are absolutely not sophisticated at all. And at one point, the best friend, Natalie, is talking about her cousin and how she has this crush on her cousin. And Lauren's like, that's gross. You can't love your cousin. And she's like, it's a second cousin. The kids don't turn out funny or anything.
But Kristen, you said something that I realized was another reason I really enjoyed this movie, because to me it was so sweet and it was charming, but it was also kind of bittersweet because of those analog moments. Mm-hmm. I think part of me was saying, this isn't necessarily going to ever happen again this way, whether it was them making that date or something really struck me a lot. There were several scenes where there was a newspaper in the scene. And it just really made me pause, like the way that somebody, I think the very first one was Arthur was, or the father was reading the newspaper, and the way he was holding the newspaper and kind of that,
yeah,
you know, that sound you kind of make that when you snap. Open it yeah. up. And yes. And then we go to Danielle when he's like circling the movie times and he's got it like folded into yes. quarters.
Yes.
And then the couple, the American couple, they're looking at the newspaper at one point, and so is Julian. And it just made me miss newspapers and the way we held them and the way we would fold them in certain ways to read certain yeah. parts of it.
It's like a tactile memory.
This is a timeless story.
Yeah.
This is a universal experience, as we know from your writing mm-hmm. and Worldwide Crush and Scott Fenwick. And I do think that there is an age group that would enjoy a movie like this today.
Oh, I think so.
I think 100%. It would yes. never yeah. get made today, which is so sad.
It will never happen again. And it's interesting. There's a lot of talk online about how they could never make this movie again because it's so dependent. The tension in the story is so dependent on it being analog. There's another great scene. It's a total Scott Fenwick scene where it's after their first date and they're walking around Paris and Lauren quickly kisses Danielle on the subway platform right before hopping on her train. Okay, first of all, like no, there's no 13-year-old who is wandering around the city of Paris and hopping on a subway by herself. I just don't think parents today would allow that to happen. And as she is the one who grabs him and kisses him super fast. It's like the most chaste kiss you've ever seen, but it's ever so exciting. And as soon as she does it, she turns around and runs and she hops on the train and the train pulls out of the station and she waves out the window at him as the train pulls away and they are both just giddy. They're giddy and
it's
I am
so cute.
Smitten. This is a total Scott Fenwick moment.
Yes.
But you realize part of the excitement is that there is no I'm going to text him from the train. Maybe we'll start talking when I get home. All they can do is wait for the next date that they've planned. And will they show up?
I mean, it's so innocent.
It's
and what
so
I think
innocent.
Has happened today yes. is that because of technology and everything, 13-year-olds aren't that innocent as they were in 1979.
Maybe. I think that there are elements of the story and the crush experience that, again, are timeless and universal. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, you might have to change it out to be a phone, and there's some things that would be different. But that longing and that giddiness, you know, you were in play practice together, let's say, and yes. then your mom's picking you up and you're, I don't know, it's the last day of school, whatever. I mean, you can still recreate those kind of moments of longing and giddiness. Mm-hmm. In today,
I want to talk about the last scene because there are several places where I cried in this film because my heart is just bursting. You're so sad for them and happy for them all at the same time, which is, you know, the very definition of bittersweet, right? And we won't tell you exactly what happens except to say that, you know, these kids are in seventh grade. They're not going to get married. Right. There has to be an inevitable parting. There just has to be. And I want to read this to you from a film blogger named Scott Ross 79. And everything that this blogger said about the film is like, well, I'm not even going to try and say anything because he just says it perfectly. So he says, when the two must part at the end, the reprise of that melody of the music that George Delarue wrote becomes nearly unbearable. And by the time George Roy Hill gives us the emotional release of Thelonious Bernard's leap up into the unforgettable freeze frame with which the movie ends and that suspends the boy in an attitude of joyous hope, it would take a stronger emotional constitution than mine not to be moved.
But it's that young love. I mean,
yes,
theirs was
love.
Kind of very
yes.
similar. Mm-hmm. And it was, oh, I'm going away, but I want to still be waving to you. I mean, you know.
We'll see each other soon, Lauren.
That's right.
I'll see you soon, Lauren, yes, when we are grown-ups.
Yes, yes.
We will see each other. And it's, I'm going to tell you listeners just a little bit more without giving away the end. Let me just say that it involves running after her car that is departing. Is it not everybody's like nightmare/fantasy that the person who loves you is like running after you as you're departing for the airport? And there is just there's this freeze frame moment and it is movie making at its finest.
It's so good.
It's mm-hmm. so good. Do you think that leap in the air that they caught in freeze frame, do you think that was improvised or do you think that he was directed to do that?
Oh, that's, let's, you know what? Let's just leave that as an open mm-hmm. thought. We can all think what we will.
Yeah. I, for
I'm
some reason,
was,
I was,
I'm going to say improvised.
I was feeling improvised and I was, you know, to Thelonious Bernard's credit, I he was so good at his job. And I thought, could he have been so wrapped up in the moment that he just leaped into the air? It's so possible. Because I think if you were scripted to leap, you might be like, one, two, three,
two,
leap.
Three, jump. Right? No, you're going, you're saying to the director, am I going to leap? Is it one, two, jump? Or is it one, two, three, jump? Right. You know how when you're trying to get everybody to jump at the same time, you're like, wait.
It is absolute, jumping it is absolute perfection. And the critics hated it. It's bad. Roger Ebert gave this movie 2 stars. The New York Times said the film was so ponderous, it seems almost mean-spirited. It's been a long time since I've seen a movie about boorish American tourists and felt sorry for the tourists. I'm sure nothing mean-spirited was intended, but such is the film's effect. This may be the main hazard when one sets out to make a film so relentlessly sweet-tempered that it winds up, like Pollyanna, alienating everyone.
No, you know what? I'm sorry. He never was in real love.
Yeah. Michelle looks uncomfortable right now, like she wants to shed her skin.
Well, yeah, and he wasn't the audience. No. I mean, that's not who the movie was made for. And if you put yourself maybe in the eyes or seat of the people that the movie was made for, you might have looked at it a little differently.
He sounds like such an adult. He sounds like an adult who has no memory of being 13.
No.
The Washington Post said, the intentional comedy in the film always seems on the verge of working, but then is quickly bludgeoned to death.
What?
I know. Bad.
I don't get that at all.
I know. These people are dumb.
Yeah. Are any of these people women?
Yes, actually, that was Judith Martin with the Washington Post.
Oh, Judith.
Well, Judith Martin has never been in real love either.
That's right. And then, so here's Roger Ebert's review. I'm going to read parts of it to you so you can just see why he gave it a 2-star review. A Little Romance has been described as a movie about the way kids behave when adults aren't looking. I think it's quite the opposite. A movie about the way kids behave when adults are looking, and when adults are writing the dialogue and directing the action, too. It gives us 2 movie kids in a story so unlikely, I assume it was intended as fantasy. And it gives us dialogue and situations so relentlessly cute, we want to squirm. The kids are played by Thelonious Bernard and Diane Lane, who are really pretty good. If you can separate how they act from what they're acting in, it's not their fault. A Little Romance is about 2 13-year-olds who could only exist in fiction and whose witty one-liners often sound as if they were authored by the writer of The Mary Tyler Moore Show, as indeed they were. These are attractive kids and they look interesting. I don't know why that's relevant. I wonder what they talked about between takes and how they acted when the cameras weren't rolling. There might be a movie there somewhere.
Okay, first of all, I'm going to say this. This is, like I'll say next week when we talk about the Scott Fenwick Diaries, this is so, it's done so authentically. Oh, yeah. Everyone take a drink.
Right, drink. Everyone drink.
And real.
Yeah.
We're a conversation you're going to hear next week is talking about how when you're 13, 12 and 13, you're often very, not everybody, not 100% of the people, but I would say most. This is all new and you're unsure and you're scared and it's complicated and it's confusing. And I think they did it amazingly. And all I want to do is can we just walk down the street and hold hands?
Yes.
And that's what, so to me, Roger Ebert is, that's such an ignorant.
Yeah,
exactly.
Such an ignorant review.
I think that's just a lot what we'll talk about next week when we talk about Scott Fenwick and why this movie might not have made an impact like we thought it should and made it around to theaters because these adults and maybe a lot of men, at least the way Roger Ebert is talking, are just making these caricatures really of what 13-year-old kids
ironically,
were like.
Ironically, yes.
It's just, it makes me really mad because it's like the people that are the furthest away from 13-year-olds, whether being them or living with them or whatever, are making these blanket statements about this is nothing what a 13-year-old would be doing. Yeah. It's really what's behind the scenes. That's the movie.
Yeah.
Don't tell us it's that.
Yeah.
Because it's not that. I mean, you've got 3 women here who grew up, who were 13 once. And
we remember it.
We remember it.
Yeah.
No, Roger Ebert. No.
Yeah.
That's all I got to say.
And let's not forget that the goal of Lauren, especially, but in this movie, is just to ride in a gondola. It's so romantic. Yes. It's called A Little Romance. Yes. It's just to ride under the bridge in a gondola and have a kiss. And spoiler alert, so close your ears, although we've already given too many spoilers.
Yeah, we know.
But
anytime they kiss, so there is another scene where they kiss, I believe it's at her birthday party after he gives her a present. And then, and in front of the friends, because Natalie's like, oh God, because she wants to have, yeah. It's just an innocent kiss.
Innocent.
There's no, that's not the big open mouth, back and forth, sloppy suction face. It's a hand holding. It's a kiss on the cheek. And it's just very, very sweet.
It's not innocent. Jenny and Greg, right? It's not a teenage romance. It's all, yes, they're 13, but it's a preteen romance. It's first love. It's not teen love. So it's not leader of the pack. It's not Jenny and Greg and from All My Children. It's a step before that, so it retains his innocence. They're not on their way to getting married. You know they won't be together forever. And what I think Roger Ebert misses about this movie is that, yes, these kids are extremely sophisticated. I mean, they bond over German existentialism. I think that's funny, actually. I think that's really
and
funny.
And that's part of the storyline.
That's part of the storyline, because nobody else gets
very
them.
Well. Right.
Nobody else will talk about German existentialism with me, except Danielle. And so what these are, yes, they're sophisticated 13-year-olds, but they are aspirational 13-year-olds. They are very grown up, and they are what we aspired to be. So this cancels out his criticism of it being unrealistic, because Roger Ebert is saying a 13-year-old would never say that. But the real question should be, would a 13-year-old want to say that, which makes it believable? Because would I get that out of my mouth? No. But do I want to be that way? Yes, I do. Okay, so the critics hated it, but what about regular people? And so here's what regular people had to say. And these are like film bloggers, commenters, and most importantly, kids, because that's the audience who saw it back in 1979. Mm-hmm. So Journeys in Classic Film said, a little romance is perfect. 10 out of 10. No notes.
I love that.
The moderator at the TCM, the Turner Classic Movies Classic Film Festival, said, I don't know if I'd call this movie perfection, but it's about as close as movies come. Mm-hmm. And then we have Scott Ross 79 again, who said, a little romance completely fulfilled my ideal of satisfying romantic whimsy. So those are real people. And then let's talk about the viewers, Michelle.
Yeah. Well, the viewers loved it too. And we're viewers. And I think we've just given a really great, you know, hour long review on it. But we have things like A Little Romance is one of the cutest teen romances ever made. Strongly recommend this film for anyone who has teens, but really for anyone looking for something wholesome and heartwarming. A Little Romance is a masterpiece. A teacher saying, I teach eighth graders and I love how realistic the kids are in this. Suck it, Roger Ebert, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one says, I watched this on TCM tonight, and I've been feeling grouchy all day, and this chased away my grumps. I know, I love that. An enchanting, lovable film. Here's a good one. I saw A Little Romance two more times before it ended its brief run at Teton Cinema there in my hometown of Jackson, Wyoming. I sat in the darkened theater, my blood quickening for those 2 hours, memorizing Diane Lane's face while she was on screen. I fell asleep each night with Diane flickering across the back of my eyelids. I fantasized about this new Hollywood princess telling her parents she'd like to vacation at the Grand Tetons that summer. And on that vacation, they'd come into town one day. And on that day, they'd decide to stop in Jackson Drug for an ice cream sundae. And on that day, I'd be sitting on the second stool from the end at that very same lunch counter, and she would take the third stool from the end, and her arm would brush mine.
God.
Right.
Mic drop. Mic drop. That's what they wanted. The director wanted somebody to experience after that film.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're you know, fantasizing about their own little romance.
Right.
But, you know, like, here's a boy who's that age,
exactly.
And he's fantasizing about something just as innocent as that whole movie. So again, I'll say it.
Ice cream
suck
sundaes.
It, Robert Ebert.
Yes.
Roger Ebert.
Right. And brushing her arm, brushing up against mine. It's as innocent as it gets.
Mm-hmm.
And real. It's as real as it gets.
Well, the joke really is on Roger Ebert, I would have to say. Because guess what? A Little Romance won a shit ton of awards, okay? As we said earlier, the film won the 1979 Academy Award for Best Original Score. It received two additional nominations for that year's Academy Awards for Best Adapted Screenplay. And it received nominations in the Golden Globe Awards for Best Supporting Actor for Laurence Olivier and Best Original Score again. And the film's young leads, Thelonious Bernard and Diane Lane, both received Young Artist Award nominations as Best Actor and Best Actress, respectively, as well as earning the film a win as Best Motion Picture Featuring Youth, Roger Ebert.
I mean, come on. Right?
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Somebody knew. The smart people knew. That's what I'll say.
They did. So obviously our final recommendation of this movie is a thumbs up.
Thumbs up, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I'm going to wind up this conversation by, again, reading from the film blogger Scott Ross 79, because, again, everything that he says is exactly what I want to say, except better. And he says, as with anything in life, from a pleasing odor to a symphonic masterwork, there are movies that encountered at an especially vulnerable moment can resonate with you for life, and that merely thinking about return you to a time and a place when you were, if not happy, at least hopeful of happiness. A Little Romance, for me, is one of those works of popular art that, while perhaps less than perfect, because exactly what is, it retains its sweetness and its charm and more than justifies my long-ago fondness for it. In fact, the ache the movie elicits from me now may be infinitely more bittersweet. I mean, I just have nothing more to say. I mean, right. He just said it so perfectly. It's the reason we talk about the movies and music from our childhoods, because we were vulnerable and innocent and full of feelings once. And that's a nice thing to remember. Thank you for listening, everybody, and we will see you next time.
And we'd like to give a special thank you shout out to some of our supporters over on Patreon. Today, we're saying thank you to Sheila, Christina, Linda, Jill, Erica, Rosarita, MP, Cheryl, Julie, Susie, Mel, Stephanie, and Kevin. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you to all our patrons.
Thank you to all of our patrons. And like I said at the top of the show, my next novel, The Scott Fenwick Diaries, is on sale on July 22nd, but you can pre-order today, starting now, anywhere where you buy books. And that would be really nice if you did that. Thank you so much. In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast, courtesy of the cast of Three's Company. Two good times.
Two happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie.
Cheers, everyone.
Cheers, everyone.
The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.